Welcome once again to our program, Interpreting the Bible Through the Ages. We're talking particularly about the quest for the historical Jesus and how scripture scholars have tried to separate the Christ of faith from the Christ of history, or the Jesus of faith from the Christ of history. And we talked about modernism, which Pope Pius X in 1907 wrote a famous encyclical about, showing how what these teachings, denying miracles, denying revelation, the possibility, and how that was really directly contrary to the teachings of the church. And then our wonderful scholar in residence here, Ron Eldren, who teaches at John Paul II Catholic High, world history, American history, and apologetics, was explaining in the section we're in now about not the old modernists of late 1800s and the early 1900s, but how modernism has infiltrated or sort of polluted the waters of modern thinking, even in Catholic thought today. So we were just at the end of the program, and he's going to repeat it again because I asked him to talk about how some of these neo or new modern Catholic thinkers are talking about very hot button issues.
Well, Father McCarthy, who we have been quoting, he identifies four different statements that were put out by some Catholic institution that he does not identify that reflects this modernist and this neo-modernist thinking. And there were four statements, and the first statement was Catholic moral teachings, quote, and this is from the statement from this organization, that do not reflect human experience, that is, divorce, contraception, protection against AIDS, alleviation of suffering at the end of life, etc., end of quote, that type thing. Again, this is a Catholic organization making this kind of a statement.
Okay.
It's questioning these kind of
the teachings of the church,
yes,
today, because they're not reflecting what many people think the church should be teaching about divorce or contraception or protection against AIDS, particularly you should be using condoms, and about end-of-life issues like assisted suicide, that the church,
yes,
isn't in line with what human experience is telling us.
Yes, and then the statement goes on to, according to Father McCarthy, that the church, quote, often gives priority to the affirmation of dogma and traditional morals rather than listening to people's search for meaning and journeying alongside them, end of quote. Another statement was, for the teaching of the church to change in its, quote, intransigent stands on sexual morals, its lack of openness regarding access to the sacraments for divorced and remarried Catholics, and its unwelcoming attitude towards homosexuals.
Now, those are three things that could go on for a discussion a long time, and the church gets great flack about that remarried couples who don't have an annulment are not allowed to receive the Holy Eucharist, and that the church has a stance, a bad stance against homosexual activity, because it says that same-sex marriage is really unnatural and wrong and contrary to the Bible. Those are really great issues today, and I don't know any pastor in the Catholic Church who doesn't deal with that problem of trying to help people in second marriages to work something out so they can come back to Holy Communion. But we have to defend constantly the teaching of the church and the teaching of Jesus, what man has joined. Pardon me, what God has joined, man and woman must not put apart.
Well, look at just in the last few years, certain statements that Pope Benedict XVI has made in regard to sexual ethics, life issues, that the world outcry that goes up against these statements. There have just been several in this past year. You know, he was in Africa not very long ago, and he made some statements about the distribution of condoms to try to fight AIDS. And boy, he was really raked over the coals by just about every country and every, even lots of Catholics and Catholic organizations for that.
And he was basically saying, this isn't the basic answer. We've got to go something deeper to change people's attitudes towards the sacredness of sexuality.
Yeah, chastity is what you need, not condoms.
And I believe it was a professor from Harvard came out and defended the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I've been studying the situation in Africa for a long time. And what the Pope said is right on target. But he did get an awful lot of flack.
Oh, yeah. And still is. Well, the fourth statement recommends that, quote, liturgical rites and symbols be more relevant to the world of today, end of quote. And I suppose they're talking about even making the liturgy even more bizarre than it's become in a lot of Catholic churches today. I suppose that's what they're referring to. Let alone, in other words, the very opposite of the kind of the trend now to a more traditional liturgy.
Going back to the Latin Mass, in many instances of people, because they wanted that clarity and that beauty and that structure. So it seems like it could be like a cancer. It continually changes and pretty soon is killed.
Well, Father doesn't identify this group that made these statements, but I can think of quite a few organizations that have or would issue similar statements to this organization.
Sure. Well, Ron, going back to the anti-modernist oath that we took when we were ordained in the 1950s from even Pius X, certainly it didn't put a stop to the spread of modernism in the church during the first half of the 20th century. But isn't it true that it stifled a lot of good theological speculation and biblical scholarship as well?
This point's been heavily debated for the last 50 years at least. And it certainly held back the progress of Catholic biblical studies for some time. Unfortunately, Pius X's condemnation of modernism in 1907 silenced a lot of Orthodox biblical scholars during this period, as well as modernists. One was the Dominican scripture scholar, Father Marie-Joseph Lagrange. He was founder of the École Biblique of Jerusalem in 1890. I think at the request of Leo XIII, if I recall right, and the distinguished scholarly journal Revue Biblique. I believe it was Philip Trower, whom we have quoted on several occasions in this series, who said that, quote, Father Lagrange will probably be recognized one day as one of the greatest figures in the history of the church, end of quote. He says that, quote him again here, his written work is vast in extent, but even so, it is less important than his influence and his double role as the founder of a school of critics, exegetes, and scholars, as a great exponent of the part to be played by biblical criticism in the knowledge and defense of the faith. He was instrumental in showing Catholic biblical scholars how the historical critical method could be employed without being detrimental to the Catholic faith and life. But at the time, it earned for him the censure of church authorities, end of quote. In fact, I think he was pretty well censored or pretty well silenced for the much of the rest of his life after that. And I've heard some negative criticism. In fact, Father McCarthy, whom we've quoted quite a bit here in the last two or three sessions, and Brian Harrison, one of his associates, they believe that although Father Lagrange did do some good things as far as scripture scholarship is concerned, they tend to think that there's something almost inherently bad in the historical critical method itself, which sort of opens, by people using it, tends, unless you're very, very careful, tends to lead to agnosticism in religious matters, and maybe even to atheism in religious matters. But when we get into Bultmann, we'll be able to.
Well, you quoted Philip Trower saying he may be one of the greatest figures in the history of the church. Who is Philip Trower?
Well, Trower is a British, I think originally he was a journalist, very intellectual, very scholarly man, very devout Catholic, written a lot of really good books on modernism and subjects of that sort.
Okay.
And we've quoted him on several occasions.
Well, can you name some other biblical scholars who were censured during the decades prior to Vatican Council II because of this great fear of the modernist poison seeping throughout the teachings of the Catholic scholars and theologians?
Yes, there were quite a few others. Another theological crisis precipitated by the clamping down on modernism that preceded Vatican II was the debate over the so-called Nobel theology, or in English, the New Theology. And one of the founders of the New Theology was a Dominican by the name of Marie-Dominique Chenu. And he and a man by the name of Louis Charlier had been censored in their works placed on the index in the 1930s by Cardinal Pietro Parenti of the Holy Office, now called the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which most people know was headed by Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger for many years, 19 years, I believe, if I recall right.
Before he was elected Pope.
Before he was elected Pope, yes. And this paper that Parenti wrote criticizing Chenu and Charlier was in 1942, and it had a major influence, according to some scholars, on Pope Pius XII's encyclical Humanae Generis that condemned these and other theologians 8 years later. He didn't condemn them by name, but he was very critical of some of their
thoughts.
Their thoughts, yes. And that included, of course, Henri de Lubac and some of those as well. In fact, some thought he was singling out Henri de Lubac more than anyone else. Parenti charged these theologians, among other things, with, quote, having followed Moeller and more radically the modernist, and belittling the value of reason and privileging religious feeling, end of quote. And by Moeller is meant Johann Adam Moeller, who was a German Roman Catholic theologian in the early 19th century, whose ideas were rejected by the church in his day as being inconsistent with some of the doctrines of the Catholic Church.
Okay, why were the works of these men condemned by the Pope?
Well, you'd have to go to Humanae Generis. It condemns the new theologians, and again, not by name, among other things, for its criticism of neo-scholasticism, which was at the time the semi-official theology of the church. It wasn't necessarily the theology of St. Thomas Aquinas, but it was started out with that, but then had developed rather considerably from that, and sometimes not always good developments. But whatever, the encyclical dismisses the charge that says, quote, the innovators reproach the philosophy of our schools for attending to the intellect alone in the process of thought, and neglecting the function of the will and the affections of the spirit, end of quote. It stated that, now we're still talking about Humanae Generis, it is one thing to acknowledge the role of these dispositions in knowing the truth, and another thing to assert the power of the will and of sentiment to the detriment of ratio, and they mean by ratio their reason, the Latin for reason, in order to diminish its role, end of quote. At John Paul II, our students in biology class have to read Humanae Generis, but not necessarily for the reasons that we're talking about here. There were certain ideas about evolution that was in that particular encyclical that was condemned by Pope Pius XII as well. But as I tell the students, because I don't teach the biology class, of course, but as I tell my students in my own classes that Pius XII did not just write that to condemn just certain ideas in evolution. He wrote it to condemn, or at least to warn about, or caution about, a lot of ideas that were floating around, including evolution, but also including the Nobel theology, according to some scholars, that was could be detrimental to the Catholic faith.
Well, wasn't the big questions at the time that Pope Pius XII said we cannot at the present time reconcile the teaching of evolution with the doctrine of the fall of Adam and Eve, that one parents caused the break between God and humankind, and that it wasn't reconcilable, at least at the time, with the church's teaching on original sin.
Well, there was some treatment of that. If I remember right, there were four elements that, which we don't need to go into here so much, but that the Pope cautioned that we got to be very careful, and even condemned. He reasserted the long-standing church teaching that all the whole human race derived from one set of parents. Okay. And in other words, there wasn't several sets of parents from which the different races descended.
They had a name for it then, I think.
Was it parthenogenesis?
It was something else. I can't think of the name. Well, anyway, that the human race came from several different sources.
And another is that, that each human being at the moment of creation had created out of nothing a soul by God. That was another thing that all Catholics... In other words, here the Pope says, it's not proven the theory of evolution is true, but there's nothing about it as such that's incompatible with the Catholic faith. Of course, St. Augustine had said that way back in the 4th century, something along that line. Okay. But nonetheless, here are four things that you have to believe if you're a Catholic in regard to the theory of evolution. Now, those are two of the things.
And that one was that we came from an original set of parents.
Yes.
Okay. Well, how did the new theology fare with the church during the 1950s? I take it not so well.
No, not very well. One has to remember that European society was in turmoil from the 1930s to the 1940s. World War, II and the Great Depression and all kinds of terrible things were happening. In an article entitled Risorsima Theology, Agionamento and the Hermeneutics of Tradition, Marcellino D'Ambrosio describes how a broad intellectual and spiritual movement arose within the European Catholic community in response to the challenge presented by a newly secularized society, a challenge that the reigning neo-scholasticism seems sorely ill-equipped to meet. He tells us that this movement drew some of its inspiration from earlier theologians and philosophers such as Moeller, whom we mentioned a while ago, Adam Moeller, Newman, John Henry Cardinal Newman, and others, including the French Catholic poets Charles Pigai and Paul Claudel. I mean, I've heard their names, but I'm not really very familiar with them.
Yeah, I'm well acquainted with Charles. I think it's Pigai, and Paul Claudel was a famous novelist.
Oh, yeah,
French novelist.
Very famous. Academic theologians involved in this movement included such Belgium and German thinkers as Emil Mersch, Dom Odo Cassell, Romano Guardini, Carl Adam, and Dom Anselm Stolz. I'm especially familiar with Guardini and Adam. In fact, I have several books of each of these men. Even though German theologians contributed to the movement, its undisputed center was in France. The movement was led mainly in France by the Jesuits Henri de Lubac and Jean Danielou of Lyon, of the province, the Dominican province, the Jesuit province there. And then also a couple of Dominicans, Yves Conger and Marie-Dominique Chenu of La Salle Choir. And that was their provincial center, I guess, in La Salle Choir. I think that was in Flanders, I'm not sure. But others who were considered part of the movement were Hans Urs von Balthasar and Louis Boyer. Louis Boyer has been one of my favorite theologians. He's a convert from the French Calvinist branch, and then he later on became a Catholic priest. Very, very good historian and Catholic theologian. The Frenchman Antoine Gilson was considered a devotee of the new theology. And also Karl Wojtyla, later Pope John Paul II, and Joseph Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict XVI, were heavily influenced by the movement. Germany's Karl Rahner and Hans Küng, and Belgium's Edward Schielebeeks were also affiliated with the new theology, as was Pierre Teilhard Chardin.
Okay, now the last three you mentioned, of course, were like Hans Küng and Edward Schielebeek were sort of questioned seriously by the church about their teachings.
Well, King had his theology license or whatever
to teach in Catholic
seminaries or colleges taken away finally.
Okay. Well, tell us some about the beliefs of this new theology, because we're talking about heavy hitters here, like DeLubach and Danielu, Congar, and then Balthasar and Carl Wojtyla and Joseph Ratzinger, who both became popes.
Well, although the various theologians associated with the new theology held different views on specific issues, D'Ambrosio says that they held similar views on a couple of things. One was that they had to speak to the church's present situation.
That's what Vatican Council tried to do.
Yes. And the reason we're talking about the new theology is because it did have such influence such an impact on the Vatican Council too, which is one of the reasons that a lot of the traditionalists, extreme traditionalists, have rejected Vatican Council too, because they think that the New World theology is nothing more than another brand of modernism. But I think one of the biggest things that differentiates the two, there may be some similarities, it's true, but I think the big thing that differentiates the two is that the modernists were very much opposed to going back to
Scripture and the Fathers.
And the Fathers, while on the other hand, or just ignored them. While on the other hand, for the most part, the new theology was their main, that's what resource among, going back to the sources, and they meant by the sources Scripture, and the tradition of the church fathers, and that kind of thing. Which is one of the reasons why, or maybe the main reasons why, that when you see the documents of Vatican Council II, when you read the encyclicals of Pope John Paul, and the books of Pope John Paul, and also of Benedict XVI, when you read the catechism, they're so full of quotations from the Bible, and quotations from Scripture, far more so than you would have found prior to Vatican Council II. It's not that, for example, the Roman Catechism or the Catechism of the Council of Trent didn't have, you know, Scripture in it, the Church Fathers quoted, but probably only about a fourth or so, I'm just throwing out some figure
sure.
there, compared to today.
Okay, well, and what are some of the other similarities?
Well, the key to theology's relevance to the present lay in the creative recovery of its past.
And that's especially the Scripture
yes.
and the Fathers.
The Church Fathers. In other words, they all saw clearly that the first step to what later came to be known as aggiornamento, I think that's an Italian word if I remember right.
Means updating.
Yeah. Had to be risorsamento or mento. I think that's the Italian way of saying it rather than the French way. A rediscovery of the riches of the church's 2,000-year treasury. That is, a return to the very headwaters of Christian tradition. And those were the two main things that sort of united all of them in some way or another.
Well, and obviously that was the main thrust. Even when Pope John XXIII called the Second Vatican Council, he said he wanted to preserve the ancient teachings of the church and make them intelligible to modern man and woman.
Yes.
And I think the Vatican Council did a great job in doing that.
These theologians shared a common view of how the Catholic Church should approach theology. They reacted against the dominance of scholasticism and the scholastically influenced manuals of theology. I imagine you had some of those when you went to seminary, Father.
And all broken down into
yes.
syllogisms.
Yes, and probably usually the ones I've seen, too, also had a lot of Greek and Latin in them. some of them did, anyway. They were also critical of how the church seemed out of touch with the modern world, and they held a more favorable view on ecumenism than the church held at the time. That is, you know, the reuniting of the various Christian churches into one church, as Christ, of course, had wished. And they thought that the methods of scholasticism, or at least the neo-scholastic variety that prevailed during the first half of the 20th century, they were too rigid and formal to provide sufficient insight to the problems that afflicted modern societies. And they believed that neo-scholasticism had strayed too far away from the original sources of revelation. scripture and commentaries on it by the church fathers and that type of thing.
And this seemed to be a valid objection.
Yes.
Okay, well, how did the new theologians hope to achieve their goal of reforming Catholic theology, way of applying truth to the modern world?
Well, their goal was to return to Catholic, Catholic theology to what they perceived as the, quote, original purity of its thought and expression, end of quote. To achieve their goal, they advocated a return to the sources of the Christian faith, namely Scripture and the writings of the Church Fathers, as we've said a couple of times here. This methodology has been called by its French name, ressourcement, meaning in French, a return to the sources. Moreover, the movement adopted an openness to dialogue with contemporary world on theological issues, something the church had for the most part, been very friendly to theology, let's say, of various Protestant theologians and like that kind of thing.
Didn't have what was called now a spirit of ecumenism.
That's correct.
That they got after Vatican Council II. Okay.
And they also developed a renewed interest in biblical exegesis and typology, art, literature, and mysticism. And also the new theologians advocating employing modern philosophy to better understanding the faith whenever it is compatible with, whenever these philosophies are compatible with Christianity. And certainly Pope John Paul II did this in a big way. He was trained in phenomenology and a particular variety of that called personalism. And you can't understand John Paul's theology at all unless one has a fairly good understanding of his personalism.
John Paul II, Ron, was very well known for his personalism in his writings. What does that personalism mean, in very briefly?
Well, I think in just a short sentence, it was more stress on the experience of the individual. Not just simply starting from, you know, that which was outside the individual's mind, but it's getting more inside of the individual and starting from there, from that perspective. But John Paul didn't ignore the objective reality that existed outside of himself. He's too much of a Thomist for that.
But he tried to balance the scholasticism just coming from the outside, objective reality.
Keep in mind, he had his doctorate in Thomism, and he had in theology, and he had his doctorate in philosophy from phenomenology or personalism. So basically, he's trying to bridge the gap between the two.
And he wrote a doctorate also on John of the Cross and his mysticism.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, to our radio audience, our time has run out. So now to our listeners, we say, may God bless you always and in always.